From the K-Rob Collection, this is Audio Antiques, featuring programs from the golden age of American radio. I'm Ken Robinson. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, CBS Radio cooperated with the federal government to create the series Americans All, Immigrants All, to combat the rising tide of racism and anti-Semitism sweeping the nation at that particular time. Americans All highlighted the many hardships minorities suffered and the numerous contributions they had made to society. It provided a counterbalance to the views of popular radio preacher Father Charles Coughlin, a white nationalist who promoted anti-minority conspiracy theories and is considered to be the Rush Limbaugh of broadcasting's golden age.
My friends, I am disclosing to you a document of which you are ignorant. A plan already prepared for your enslavement under the title of democracy. Can you not foresee the passing of democracy under the false front of preserving democracy? Can you not see the rise of a ruthless dictator who is a servant of the gold hoarders and a puppet of the invisible forces? Will herd the women of America, will separate mothers from their children, and compel them even to a greater degree than they were compelled in Russia. Can you not envision the closing down of schools when children, even under 16 years of age, will be forced to become cogs in a machine for murder?
Coughlin also supported some of the fascist policies of Nazi Germany. So in 1938, the Americans All, Immigrants All series took to the airwaves for 26 weeks, promoting equality and inclusion. We're going to hear three episodes, the first highlighting African Americans, the second featuring Hispanics, and the third focusing on Asian Americans. Why spend a fortune on expensive imaging programs? Look no further. Introducing GIMP, the revolutionary open source imaging software. With its user-friendly interface and powerful features, you'll be amazed at what you can create. Edit your pictures like a pro, retouch your images flawlessly, and bring your creative vision to life. GIMP offers a wide range of tools and effects that will transform your ordinary photos into extraordinary works of art. Plus, GIMP's open source community means endless possibilities. Share your work, learn from others, and be part of a vibrant creative community that's always pushing boundaries. And the best part? GIMP is completely free. Say goodbye to expensive subscriptions and hello to unlimited creativity. Why wait? Download GIMP today and join millions of satisfied users who have already discovered the power of open source imaging software.
Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair.
A standard brilliantly fine, uniting American all. The refugees signify, step up, peace of immigrants all.
Americans all, immigrants all. This is the story of how you, the people of the United States, made America. You and your neighbors, your parents and theirs. It is the story of the most spectacular movement of humanity in all recorded time. The movement of millions of men, women, and children from other lands to the land they made their own. It is the story of what they endured and accomplished. And it is also the story of what this country did for them. Americans all, immigrants all.
Uniting American all, the heroes it glorifies. Remember, we're immigrants all.
To Today we bring you the story of one immigrant who did not come of his own free will, the Negro. Brought here as slaves for nearly 200 years, emancipated only 75 years ago, the Negroes were and are a challenge to democracy and an important part of our economic and social development.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows what Jesus.
At the beginning, the Negro came to America as any other man came.
Columbus sails on his first voyage, and Pedro Alonso, the Negro, pilots one of his ships.
Balboa discovers the Pacific, and Negro fellow explorers stand beside him.
Negro artisans work with the Spanish settlers on the oldest buildings in the country at St. Augustine, Florida.
The explorers who first penetrate into New Mexico and Arizona are led by Estevanico, a Negro.
They came presently as indentured servants, like the English, Scots, and Scotch-Irish. 30 years after the first Negro servants had been landed in Jamestown, there were only a few hundred in all of Virginia. Then, something happened.
But I assure you, sir, I am not selling my tobacco to anyone else. You are my only friend in London. Why should I betray you?
But I had hoped for five times as much. 3 years ago when I was here last...
These gentlemen will bear witness.
You yourselves have made it impossible for us to raise more tobacco.
We have? You're mocking me. Why, we want more and more.
Tobacco, sir, is a hard crop to raise. A rain falls, and before the ground is dry, you have to move thousands of plants quickly and carefully from seedbed to hills. And that means we need many hands to do the work.
Surely you have no want of men here. Each ship that sails from Tilbury or Liverpool is crowded.
Aye. Until a few years ago, that was well enough. Your ship brought us a servant. He was under bond to work for 5 or 7 years. And he did work. But now, we cannot get enough indentured servants anymore. They come now as free men and take up their own land or set up as carpenters or smiths. And we are left without men to work our plantations.
In New England, where I live, the condition is much the same, gentlemen. We need shipwrights and seamen, and we have too few.
I tell you, sir, we must have men to labor, or the commerce of the colonies will fail utterly.
Well, is there no other source? I saw some Negroes on one plantation.
There are a few. Some are held as slaves, and some have freed themselves, but...
If you cannot get indentured servants from England, gentlemen, you might put your thoughts to getting slaves from Africa.
Because the country needed men to do hard work, to clear the wilderness and plant crops, the slave trade began in earnest.
Stolen from Africa, from the great Bantu tribes.
From the Sudanese, from the black and brown Hamites.
From a continent with a culture of its own.
By the tens of thousands in the early years.
By the hundreds of thousands in the later years.
Chained like animals, packed into fetid and filthy ships, with only half expected to survive the voyage, they were the victims of the most appalling trade in history.
In that trade, men of all ranks took part and profited. Not only slave raiders and slave owners and drivers, but ship merchants, political leaders, bishops, noblemen, and even royal families of Great Britain took their share of the profit and the guilt. Puritans in New England and plantation owners in the South were both involved in a traffic which began with theft in Africa and ended with slavery in the United States.
But as this inhuman traffic went on, the colonial conscience that had written the Declaration of Independence and declared all men created free and equal was troubled. And for a moment, there was a chance that slavery would be abandoned. Washington prayed for abolition. Kosciuszko deeded his property to Thomas Jefferson with instructions to purchase Negroes and give them liberty in my name. Jefferson contemplated freeing his slaves, and the slave trade, with all its unmentionable horrors, was legally forbidden in 1807.
But in the meantime, a Yankee schoolmaster, on holiday on a plantation near Savannah, Georgia, changed the course of history. His name was Eli Whitney. One day, as Whitney and his host watched the Negro...
Mr. Whitney, I'm sure my cousin Randolph could tell you more. Randolph, will you soon be done?
I didn't mean to disturb him. It's only idle curiosity.
I'm sorry if I've kept you waiting. The work's going so slowly today.
Yes, it does seem slow to me.
Oh, you Yankees always do things in a hurry.
I wish you could hurry my slaves at the cotton.
Your cousin says that each seed must be taken out separately.
And the wisps of cotton stick to the seed. It's remarkably difficult to be quick, yet...
But as we passed those women over there, I thought I saw one of them using a little device, like a comb.
I hope it was no comb of mine.
Oh, it seemed more like a curry comb.
Oh.
That must be some of Sam's work. Sam's a good craftsman. Sam, come here.
Come on, master.
Sam, Mr. Whitney's been watching the way we pick seeds out of the cotton. Did you make that little comb the women use?
I did, master, down at the forge.
Where did you learn to work iron, Sam?
From my father, sir.
Oh, yes. Sam's father was a very good craftsman. He worked out most of the wrought iron you see on the balustrades and the porches.
Are you as good a workman as your father, Sam?
I try to be, sir. Not so much to do with the forge as they used to be.
Tell me, what made you think of the comb?
Well, the cotton sticks, sir. But if you could put some teeth through it, the seeds would be loose. It helps a little, sir, but not very much.
Well, it's in the right direction, Sam. Thank you.
All right, Sam. Go back to the forge if you want to make another.
Well, thank you, master.
An unusually capable Negro, isn't he?
Oh, we have several as good. You Yankees, Mr. Whitney, always think that our Negroes are nothing but field hands. They are good carpenters and smiths. Some of them could build you a house. But these scratchers or combs they make, they never serve in the end. I tell you, Mr. Whitney, if a man could make a mechanism which could extract the seeds from the cotton, he would win the gratitude of every planter in Virginia and Georgia, and in every state where cotton grows.
A machine. These Negroes have already made their little devices for pulling out the seed. If only something more could be done.
Before he had left the plantation of his friends, Eli Whitney had worked out the basic principles of the cotton gin, and the entire course of history was changed. By the time Whitney's cotton gin was perfected, one man with a machine could do the work of 1,000 working by hand.
But more cotton meant more drudgery for the Negro, and finally poverty for the whites, for cotton exhausts the soil on which it grows. The crops in Virginia and the Carolinas began to dwindle.
I don't think I can bear it. Everything will be spoiled. Oh, Frederick, do we have to go?
We can't stay and live like gentlefolk. Here, Tom, have the stoves been put on the wagon?
Yes, they have, sir. We're almost ready. If you and the missus will take the carriage...
But I don't want to go. Oh, Frederick, we were both born here.
We shall starve here if we stay, my dear. Tom, you know how things have been going. Tell my wife.
Well, ma'am, it's very simple. Your father planted cotton, and his father before him. But this land won't bear cotton anymore.
Well, then why can't we raise something else?
We can, my dear, but we should live like the poor whites in the hills.
You see, ma'am, the land in Alabama is new. It bears cotton. My son's out there, and he writes that the Marions, your cousins, I think, ma'am, have a plantation of 10,000 acres there, and remarkably fertile.
But I don't want to leave Carolina. This is our home.
So the slave owners wept over leaving their birthplace. For the slaves themselves...
Notice! The advertiser now at Barnum City Hotel wishes to buy 35 or 40 slaves. They will be bought in families or separate. They are to be settled in Alabama.
In Alabama? We're going to take you to Alabama.
They sold me, Martha. And they wouldn't sell you.
Oh, Jim, Jim, they can't take you away. They can't.
Seems they can, Martha.
Oh, come after you, Jim. They can't keep us apart. Oh, they can't.
Hush, hush, Martha.
Jim.
Maybe we'll both get away.
My Lord, deliver Daniel. My Lord, deliver Daniel. Why can't he deliver me?
Because slave labor was available, the Southwest was built up.
Because slave labor was available, the supply of cotton increased, enriching the South and bringing prosperity to the factories of the North.
Negro labor was concentrated on four crops: tobacco, sugar, rice, and cotton. and each was produced on a larger scale than had ever been dreamed of before. The growth of the United States in international trade depended in large part on these crops. Cotton alone made up two-thirds of all the goods sold abroad by the United States before the Civil War.
Under the lash of slavery, the Negro maintained a magnificent patience. But the human spirit rose and reasserted itself, and many individuals struck out for freedom. Among these heroic figures, the greatest of all was Frederick Douglass, the famous Negro anti-slavery orator and statesman. Here is his story.
My name used to be Bailey, but I changed it when I ran away to Frederick Douglass. When I was young, there was a law against teaching slaves to read and write. But my mistress taught me a little, and I learned more by watching others. My master leased me out as an apprentice. I learned something about shipbuilding in Baltimore, and soon I determined to make myself free. For some time, I had been writing free passes for runaway slaves. Eventually, I wrote one for myself.
Train for Philadelphia. All aboard.
Does this train connect with the train for New York?
It does. You'll get to New York about 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. My boat sails at 10. Hope we won't be late.
Yeah, what boat's that?
Ark of Freedom.
All aboard.
You'll get there in time. They'll never set sail without the cook.
All aboard.
I cooked in the shipyards in New Bedford, and I began to make speeches against slavery. Then the Anti-Slavery Society made me its agent. And for years I traveled and spoke, and was sent to Great Britain and to Belfast in Ireland. And I said to the people there, a few years later I escaped from my chains, gained partial freedom, and became an advocate for the emancipation of my race. Persecuted, hunted, outraged in America, I have come to England, and behold the change. Chattel becomes a man. I breathe, and I am free.
Mr. Douglas, in addition to the sum which has been raised here to help your unfortunate brothers, the people of Belfast, to show the esteem in which they hold you, have raised the sum of £150 to be sent to your former master so that you may never again be in danger of slavery.
I cannot thank you sufficiently. I really cannot. But I am happy to buy my freedom legally, since I had to take it years ago.
Frederick Douglass returned to America to work for abolition. And with him, side by side, were William Lloyd Garrison, John Brown, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Whittier, the Quaker poet, and Carl Schurz, the German. And even Negro women leaders like Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. Higher and higher rolled the tide of opposition to slavery when out of the West came a voice.
A house divided against itself cannot stand. This nation cannot continue to exist half slave and half free.
He seen the smoke way off the river where the Lincoln gunboats lay. He took his hat and left very sudden, in effect he's running away.
The Negroes were caught up in the clamor of war. In the North they fought 200,000 strong for freedom. In the South, entrusted with the care of women and children, left alone on thousands of plantations, they remained faithful to that trust, even raising the food and raw materials which supplied the Southern armies.
All the way up the river where the Lincoln gunboats lay, he took his hat and left very Southern and expect he'd run away.
A new era began after the Civil War. Unprepared for freedom, unused to self-government, abused by the victors, the Negro struggled and suffered throughout the Reconstruction period, and the South suffered with him. Yet even in those chaotic days, one great constructive reform was achieved.
Granted, and using the right to vote, the Negro successfully fought for a system of public school education established by law and supported by the states.
Immediately, the whole race, young and old, went to school. Few were too young and none too old to try to learn.
Helpful. H-E-L-P-F-U-L-L.
No, not quite. Can you spell it, Grandpa?
H-E-L-P-F-U-L.
That's right, Grandpa.
I'll learn to read the book before the young rascal will. Show me the story of Moses, teacher. I want to read.
Presently, colleges were founded, some by the Negroes, some by philanthropic white men. A few years after the Civil War, Hampton was founded by General Samuel Armstrong on the then revolutionary principles of work for the hands as well as work for the brain. And out of Hampton rose another school.
General Armstrong, we need your help.
I'm always happy to help you. What do you need?
We're from Tuskegee, and we've been lucky, General. The legislature passed our application for a school. They've given us a little money.
Well, that's splendid. What do you need?
A teacher. A man to make the school.
Would you take a young man?
If he's willing to work.
Well, he's willing. His name is Booker Washington. He was a slave. Now, I'll talk to him, and as soon as he decides, he'll come down to you.
The school to which Booker T. Washington went was an old wooden church and a broken-down chicken coop on a plot of land. On that land, buildings were erected. To them, young students came, working their way, and training of body and mind was practiced there, as at Hampton, until the name of Tuskegee stood in the first rank of educational institutions, and Booker T. Washington was known throughout the world.
Many years later, another kind of self-help in education rose out of the gift of Julius Rosenwald, a Jewish philanthropist who gave $4 million to help establish schools for Negroes. In dimes and quarters, $4 million more was raised by Negroes themselves. Contributions from white friends, regular school taxes were added, and 5,000 Rosenwald schools now are in operation.
Before emancipation, most Negroes had been actually prevented from learning. In the brief years since, the Negro has not only conquered illiteracy, but through poets like Paul Laurence Dunbar, story writers like Charles W. Chestnut and others, he has begun to make an important contribution to American literature.
Directly out of his passion for education came one of Negro's noblest contributions to American life. It began far back, when Fisk University was desperate for funds to continue its work. On October 6, 1871, a small group stood at the railway station in Nashville.
Are you ready, Mr. White?
We should start in a few minutes. Have you all brought everything? Are you scared, Tom?
No, not scared. But no one has ever sung our songs before in public like that.
Mr. White, could I ask you something?
Why, certainly, Hannah.
Why do we have to sing the slave song?
Well, why, my dear? Don't you want to?
Well, some of us can remember. Well,
you
when...
can remember. You can sing them just because you can remember. They are your Jubilee songs. And surely slavery was no shame to you. Now, come. Hold your heads up. And when we get to Oberlin...
and girls from Nashville. They are singing the plantation songs their fathers and mothers sang as slaves. But they are singing them to raise money for the school at which they are gaining their education.
Sweet home, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me
singers conquered the world. They sang at the White House and before Queen Victoria. They raised the money by which Fisk University was saved. They started out with $2 and came back with $80,000. And they began to make known to the world the songs which the Negroes in the South had been singing for years. The great contribution of the Negro to all American music, both classical and popular, has become increasingly important. Negro composers, among them William Grant Still, Nathaniel Dett, William L. Dawson, Harry Burley, W.C. Handy, all have been acclaimed among the most original and creative forces in our music. Negro singers, among them Marian Anderson, Roland Hayes, Jules Bledsoe, and Paul Robeson, have delighted concert audiences with their singing in this country and Europe. European opera has welcomed the greatest voices from our Negro singers. Americans have thrilled to the warmth and beauty of their rendering of classical pieces and of the simple Negro spirituals.
I looked over Jordan and what did I see? A river to carry me home. A band of angels calling after me. Coming for to carry me home.
With the dawn of freedom and education for the Negro, his range of activities began to expand. He could move about in pursuit of employment.
After the Civil War, more industries established themselves in the South. Lumber and turpentine, steel and iron and coal.
The Negro went into the camps, the mines, the mills, and railroads were being built.
Railroad down the river, steamboat.
I can use 500 men in Missouri. Good pay.
Here we come.
1,000 men in Kansas. Good pay and good food.
Here we come.
2,000 men for the coal mines in Ohio. Good pay and good houses.
Here we come.
5,000 men for the railroads.
Here we come.
Gone.
Satisfied with conditions in the South, the Negroes migrated to various parts of the country. The exodus was so great, the landowners in the South were worried and took steps to stop the movement. But whenever work was to be done and men were lacking, the Negro was called to the West or to the North. When the United States entered the World War and a labor shortage developed, the Negro was asked by manufacturers to come north.
Wanted, at once, 10 families and 5 men for permanent work in the Connecticut tobacco fields. Inquire.
Good steady employment for colored workers, 30 to 40 cents an hour. Good warm sanitary quarters free. Apply box 367.
$3.60 a day can be made in steel foundry in Minnesota.
3,000 laborers to work on the railroad.
Men wanted for steel mills. Good pay.
Though the Negro went north for better wages, he found only old tenements, dreary, unsanitary rooms to live in, and many other hardships in his new work. The supply of available labor dropped when immigration was restricted. Again, jobs were offered, and hundreds of thousands of Negroes moved to the manufacturing cities, still without adequate housing to receive them. Many stayed in the cities in the South. But of the 1.5 million who left the farm, the major part went north.
Such a movement of population could not occur without hardships and friction. Before the full value of the Negro in industry could be assessed, the depression of the late 1920s occurred. And perhaps the Negro has suffered most because, it is often said, he is the last to be hired and the first to be fired.
Only 75 years have passed since the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. As a slave, the Negro was prevented from exercising any of his talent except his talent for work. Yet,
he contributed his labor to opening up the country and to supplying the great basic crops on which commerce flourished.
After emancipation, when industry multiplied, he was still hampered and held back.
He was called wherever labor was needed and helped in the railroads, the shops, the mills, the mines.
Nearer our own time, education fits him for new tasks.
Dr. Daniel Williams of Chicago performs the first successful operation on the human heart.
George Washington Carver helps to revolutionize agriculture in the South. He extracts over 145 commercial products from the peanut, 100 others from the sweet potato.
The Negroes become artists. Henry O. Tanner, Aaron Douglas, Sergeant Johnson, Richmond Barthé, Augusta Savage.
They become architects. Paul R. Williams, Vertner W. Tandy, Albert Cassell.
They become educators. Mary McLeod Bethune, Robert R. Moulton, John Hope, Kelly Miller, Mordecai Johnson.
And actors. Bert Williams, Charles Gilpin of Emperor Jones, Richard Harrison of Green Pastures, Paul Robeson, Rose McClendon, Rex Ingram, Ethel Waters.
And poets and novelists, Langston Hughes, Claude McKay, Counter Cullen, Jesse Fawcett, Richard Wright, Sora Neale Hurston.
William Burghardt Du Bois devotes his searching intellect and brilliant pen to an analysis of the race problem in America and raises a cry for civil rights and social justice.
The late James Weldon Johnson used his legal ability and his diplomatic tact to serve his country and his race for years. And, poet as well as leader, embodied the ideals and hopes of the Negro in a song which has become an anthem.
Sing a song full of the faith that the darkness has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of a new day begun, let us march on till victory is won.
This hymn of the Negro's faith in the future brings to an end the brief sketch we have made of his contributions to American life in the past. The Negro's greatest contribution must always be the unfolding of a race, once enslaved, largely self-educated, to meet the new demands made upon the citizen of today.
Today, we have only highlighted the moving story of the Negro in the United States. You will want to know more about what the Negro has given to the pattern of American life, about his struggles and contributions, about the great names of his race. The Office of Education is glad to announce another free leaflet for you, a leaflet to answer your questions about the Negro in the United States, also about winning freedom, and two forthcoming programs, French and Netherlanders, and Upsurge of Democracy. It includes suggestions for individual study and group activities, and a list of books for your reading on all the programs of this series. You will want to have and save a copy of this leaflet.
A standard brilliantly fine, uniting American soul. The refuge it signifies, says heartbeats of immigrants.
Americans All, Immigrants All is presented by the United States Department of the Interior and the Columbia Broadcasting System with the assistance of the Service Bureau for Intercultural Education and the Works Progress Administration. The script was written by Gilbert Seldes and the research by Rachel Davis Du Bois and Philip Leonard Green. The original music by Rudolf Schramm was played by the CBS String Orchestra conducted by Leon Goldman. The entire production was under the personal direction of Philip Cohen. Your narrators have been
Gene Leonard and
Niles Welch.
Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair.
Americans All, Immigrants All. This is the story of how you, the people of the United States, made America. You and your neighbors, your parents and theirs. It is the story of the most spectacular movement of humanity in all recorded time. The movement of millions of men, women and children from other lands to the land they made their own. It is the story of what they endured and accomplished. And it is also the story of what this country did for them. Americans All, Immigrants All. Today, in a correction of popular history, we bring you the immigrant who created America's most romantic legend and one of its basic industries.
The hero victory boy, remembered with immigrants all.
Long before Virginia was settled, long before the landing at Plymouth Rock, St. Augustine became the first permanent settlement in present-day United States.
The Spaniard comes to America.
Didn't the Spaniard come only for gold and then go away?
The early exploration was partly for gold. The Spaniard stayed in the Southwest. The Spaniard comes to Mexico.
Cortez is marching. He has burned his ships at Veracruz, so there can be no retreat. He is marching on Mexico City. And in the great palace, the Aztec messengers run to Montezuma bearing news.
These men have come to our shores in floating towers from the waters of heaven.
They carry thunder in their hands, in rods that flash fire, and they ride upon strange beasts as swift as the wind.
Their faces are as pale as the moon. Oh, mighty one, with hair growing upon their chins.
These are gods, not men. This is the fair-skinned god Quetzalcoatl. Our priests have said that someday he would come to us over the waters of the great sea from the land of the rising sun. What does he want with us, do you know?
He is hungry for gold, oh, mighty one.
Then give him gold. We must appease him. Take the two great wheels of gold and silver from the storehouse. Take the jeweled feathers and the bowl full of gold dust. Even Montezuma must pay homage to Quetzalcoatl.
Gold for Cortez. What does Cortez give to America in exchange?
15 horses and a few long-horned Andalusian cattle. The first ever seen on this continent. The entire history of America, its economy and its heroic legends, were all profoundly affected by this unintended gift. The cattle and horses march into Texas, westward into California, brought by the Spaniards, accompanied by Indians. See how men of a dozen other nations are drawn in to complete a great chapter in the making of America.
What was Mexico when the Spaniards came?
The most advanced civilization in North America. Architecture, astronomy, agriculture were all understood. And when Spanish culture came, by fire and sword, the two were joined. Great cathedrals were built. Great ranches were established. And while the exploration of Mexico went on, the pleasures of European life were introduced to America. Meanwhile, the Spanish exploration continued.
Ponce de Leon in Florida.
Alvar Nunez Cajiza de Vaca breaks the trail from Florida to Mexico.
Hernando de Soto discovers the Mississippi.
Estevanico the Negro sees the pueblos of the Zuni Indians.
Francisco Vasquez Coronado in his glittering armor.
With 260 conquistadores on horseback and 60-foot soldiers with crossbows and harquebuses.
And 1,000 extra horses for baggage.
And 900 Indians.
And one Indian whose self-sacrifice was stronger than all Coronado's horses, munitions, and men.
Where's the Indian guide? The one they call the Turk.
Outside the tent, General.
Bring him in.
General.
Passes understanding, Fry One. Are you sure that this is the way you came before?
Who can be sure on these plains that are without landmarks? But the seven cities of Cibola should be near.
Near? Where are they? Where are the houses of gold with doors of turquoise and silver? Where is that Indian who is leading us?
Here is the Indian, General.
Speak to him, Fry One. Tell him we must find the seven cities, not these Indian huts he brings us to.
He understands well enough. El Turco, you understand?
El Turco understands.
Where is the king you spoke of who sleeps beneath a tree decked with little golden bells? And the women who draw water in pitchers of solid gold? Answer me!
El Turco does not know where is gold. El Turco told story of gold to lead white men far away from pueblos of his people.
He has betrayed you, Don Francisco.
White men kill many Indians. Indians hope many white men get lost and die on prairie.
Madre de Dios! You lead me astray, you protect your people. You shall die for this.
Better one die, his people live.
Impale him on a spike as an example to the rest of these savages. Lead him away.
Don Francisco, have mercy on his soul.
These Indians have no souls, Fry One. It's useless you're trying to convert them to Christianity. Our whole expedition has been useless. All these weary months of wandering. And for what? So that we may plod the same long trail back again to Mexico and disgrace.
I shall not go back to Mexico. I shall go with you as far as the pueblos of El Turco's people. There I will stay.
But they'll kill you.
Perhaps they will. But this Indian was ready to die for his people. Shall I be less ready to die doing the Father's work? You say they have no souls, Don Francisco. You are angry. And in anger, your theology is bad. They have souls. You can see it in their love for one another. So great that whole communities can live together peacefully in a single pueblo, sharing the work and food. And they have faith in God, such faith that their prayers bring rain from heaven.
It is not our God.
And that is what we shall teach them. Perhaps we can learn a great deal from the Indians, too. Already they have taught us how to cultivate their grain. Imagine it, grain in a desert.
Perhaps they'll teach you how to build a church without stone or bricks. A cathedral in the desert, Fry One. A cathedral of mud like the pueblos.
Well, perhaps they will, Don Francisco. Perhaps they will.
Although many Spaniards oppressed the Indian, they also accepted him. far more heartily than other Europeans did. By intermarriage and by working with the Indian, the Spaniard learned what the Indian had to teach. And above all,
the native Indian of America had tamed the wilderness and created more than half of the crops upon which America lives to this day.
Corn,
potatoes,
tobacco,
coffee,
fruits.
The Spaniards were led by soldiers and priests and accompanied, as Columbus was, by Jewish scientists. Moors and Negroes cleared away into the entire Southwest. Kansas, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, where finally the search for gold was abandoned and the conversion of the Indians to Christianity led to the creation of the great missions. Then came the presidios, fortresses to protect the missionaries and their converts and farming communities. The oranges, dates, and grapes brought over from Spain by Fray Junipero Serra were the beginning of California's fruit industry. The California Indian learned to use Spanish implements and methods of agriculture. Just as in the missions, they found the first primitive manual training schools in America. Meanwhile, in Texas, the herds of horses and cattle have multiplied.
I don't like the way these cattle are acting, Pedro. They're so uneasy.
They are always uneasy, senor. Even our tame cattle are growing wild.
No? They have too much freedom. But today, there's something decidedly wrong. I can feel it.
Senor, look! Coming over that hill.
Wild horses.
Madre mia. Hundreds of them.
Watch out for the cattle. Don't let them stampede.
The horses, senor. They are coming right at us.
I'll try to head them off.
Senor, look out.
It's no use. We can't stop them, Pedro. Ride, Pedro. Ride. Ride.
In California, desperate settlers drive thousands of wild horses over cliffs into the sea to drown. But still the herds of wild animals multiply. 300 years after Cortes brought his 15 horses and his few cattle, droves of both roam the southwestern plains. Texas, meanwhile, has changed hands from Spain to Mexico. And now in the 1820s, immigrants from Georgia and Tennessee came riding westward.
Another drove of them scrawny longhorns. Seems like this country's plumb full of cattle.
Say, there's some men amongst that bunch, Steve. Look, one's wrestling with a steer.
Come on, let's see what they're doing.
Better have your gun ready, son.
Well, they look friendly enough, even if they are foreigners.
Them hats must have been made for men 10 times their size. Look at the leather pants they're wearing.
Howdy, sir.
Howdy.
Good day, senores. You are welcome to the rancho.
Good day to you.
You have come far?
Me and the boy rode clear from Georgia.
Juanita, make the gentleman welcome.
Gladly, Federico. You are welcome, American gentleman.
Thank you.
It is very hot. Will you come on the veranda, out of the sun?
Why, it's kind of you, man.
The horses, Pablo, take them to the corral.
Si, senor.
Pretty place you have here. Call this a hacienda?
Oh, this is not so grand. Just a simple ranch we have here.
My, that's a pretty cloth you're making there.
Juanita is very skillful.
Weave that cloth yourself, man?
We all do, senor. Well, here is a cool drink for you.
Women seem to make mighty fine lace. Look at that, Dad. Better than grandma's, don't you think?
It's a pleasant life here, senor.
Yes, it is not hard, and we have not too much to do.
Seems you got time to plant flowers all about.
My daughters and I plant the flowers. Sometimes the weather is too dry, and then we fetch the water from the arroyo.
Dye, eh? Say, how's this part of the country for raising cotton, senor?
For cotton? You do not want cotton, surely, senor. This country is for cattle.
Oh, but we ain't got no cattle.
There are many cattle and horses on the prairie.
You mean to say them critters are free for the taking? They're wild?
Si, senor. If they have no brand of rancho.
You mean we just gotta catch them?
Si, senor. But to catch, she is not so easy.
Well, I reckon we can learn, can't we, Steve?
I reckon. Free land, free horses, free cattle. Why, it's a gold mine. Dad, we're going to be rich.
All day on the prairie in a saddle I ride. Not even a dog boy to trot by my side. My fire I must kindle with chips and the round. And boil my own coffee without being ground. I wash in a pool and I wipe on a sack. I carry my wardrobe all there on my back.
So began the career of the American cowboy. chiefly men of Scottish and English descent, move west and south and settle among the Mexican ranchers. Animals, sombreros, lariats, tools, and habits of living are taken over from the Spanish and Indian ways. The cattle kings appear, but cattle raising is not yet a way to wealth.
We're cattle poor, that's what we are. Cows are as thick as rattlers out here, and just as worthless.
But they aren't worthless. By the English method of breeding, we are involving one of the finest beef cattle in the country.
What's the good of beef if there ain't nobody to eat it?
You face the same problem, amigos, that has troubled my forefathers for generations. To the south lies Mexico, with too many cattle of our own. To the west, California, with too few people. And hemming us in on the north and the east are Indians, riding the ponies which they have captured from the wild herds of my forefathers. Now you understand, senores, why we have let those herds run wild.
But we can't afford to do that. We've got to find somebody to buy. Plenty of people in the East need beef. They pay good money for these critters. All we got to do is to get them to market.
He's right, you know. We must reach a market.
Si, senores, but the market is not so easy to reach.
Before a market could be found, all the other national and racial strains in America had to combine.
Break through the prairies, build railroads.
So far, there was not enough incentive to do these things. But on the Pacific coast, an agreeable civilization had been established.
Tell me, Padre, is there any truth in these tales of gold I hear?
Perhaps, my son, but we are not seekers for gold. The conquistadores, like your ancestors who came to Virginia, put too much faith in what they might find beneath the ground. We of California are finding our riches above the ground.
Above it?
In these vineyards, in the olive trees and oranges which we have brought from old Spain. In these fields which were desert and which we have watered and made fruitful.
But if you could find gold...
Life is better than gold.
Because pleasant settlements were established in California, men drifted toward it, overland across the mountains, by sea round Cape Horn. English, Scottish, Germans, French, Swiss, Russians, mingled with the Spanish and Indians. The seals in the coastal waters attracted trappers. The soil, easy to work and overwhelmingly productive, made farming agreeable. The life of the Spanish landowners was easy, amusing, and healthy. And the patient Spanish missions had broken down the hostility of the Indians of the Sierras.
Civilization attracted men to California, and men found...
Gold! Gold, I tell you, Sutter. There can be no mistake.
So? It must be. You hammered it?
I pounded it. Look, like this. You see? It doesn't crumble. It flattens. It must be gold.
You found it in the mill race?
It washed down with the silt. I saw it this morning. I came right away.
Good. You're a good man, Marshal. Now we must keep secret the whole thing. If anyone finds out...
6 months later, men of all the nations of the world were beating their way to California. The gold once sought, then forgotten by the Spanish conquistadores, had been found. In half a year, San Francisco lost 3/4 of its population to the gold fields. Chinese were brought in to take the place of the departing men, to be cooks and servants. And then they, in turn, went off to hunt gold.
Gold knows no law.
Rob the stagecoach.
Jump a claim.
Steal.
Rob.
Murder.
The vigilantes take over San Francisco after law and order have collapsed. They strike down the highwayman and the political grafter. But in the countryside, no one rises to protect the innocent.
No pay dirt today.
This claim's worked out.
You fellas always in a hurry while last year...
We know about last year. You found a nugget after all the boys went back. That was last year.
We'll have to move.
Where you aiming to move to?
Up the gully, 10 miles or so beyond the fort.
That's that Spaniard's land.
Speak your caution, Spaniard's land. California's ours now. Been for years.
Let's go down to Jake's place and see if any more of the boys will be moving soon. I wouldn't be surprised...
Yes, I was saying, and I'll say it again. Them as won't work their places, they got no right to them. What do you say, Sheriff?
That's right, Jake. We got to clean this country out of loafers and murderers.
Hiya, boys.
Hiya, Jake.
Well, Sheriff, I see you got $5,000 posted from Murrieta.
Dead or alive.
Excuse me, I am a stranger here, passing through to French Joe's place. Do you know it?
You're a little out of your way, stranger. Frenchman, aren't you?
Yes, I was interested in this criminal. You will have a drink, yes? Everybody?
Set him up, Jake. The Ferner is buying. You ask about Murrieta, stranger. Well, sir, he's the toughest hombre in California. He's king of the bandits. I reckon Joaquin killed nigh on to 300 men.
300? But why?
Well, it seems like Joaquin got a grudge against Americans. He's a Spaniard himself. Come in from Mexico with the 49ers. That right, boys?
Sure, that's right, Sheriff.
Well, folks say is how he was living real peaceful-like, till a bunch of Americans jumped his claim. You know these Spaniards, they farm their land, and you can't get at the gold. That ain't right. The gold in California belongs to them as can take it.
But forgive me, I thought the Spaniards have been here for generations.
That's the way Joaquin Murrieta figured. There weren't no law against Mexicans digging gold, you see? But them Americans didn't wait for laws. They just beat him up. His wife, too, I hear say.
Do you think perhaps that this Murrieta has reason for grudge?
Reckon he has at that. But we can't tolerate 300 murders. Just let me get close to Joaquin once. $5,000, dead or alive.
I wish you good luck, Sheriff, if you ever do. Now I go along to my friend, French Joe. Adios.
Nice spoken young man, that.
Say, Sheriff, that's a queer thing.
What's a queer thing?
He said adios. Why, that's Spanish. Tain't French, is it?
Well, I'll be... Hey, Joe! Boys, come out here, quick! What is it? What dropped here? Take a look at that handbill.
$5,000.
Yeah, look what's scribbled underneath.
I will give $10,000 myself. Joaquin Murrieta. Say, you don't suppose that stranger was Murrieta?
I reckon he was. And me saying I'd like to get close to him. Of all the bold, insulting hombres.
By the time California settled down, the chain of events leading back to Texas was complete. Note the steps.
The cattle go north. Civilized life attracts settlers to California. Gold is discovered.
The roads to California break through the prairie.
The cattle can come to market.
And as the West develops, the railroad comes.
From San Antonio, across the San Marcos, to Austin.
From Austin, across the Brazos River, to Fort Worth.
From Hell's Half Acre at Fort Worth, to St. Joe. Crossing the Red River, and on to Monument Rocks.
From there to North Fork, to Red Fork, to Turkey Creek, to Polecat Creek.
To the line of the river, on to Slate Creek, to Cowskin Creek, to the Arkansas River, on to Abilene.
300,000 head of longhorn cattle in 1866 from San Antonio to Abilene.
400,000 in 1868.
600,000 in 1871.
So the great cattle industry came to America. Its animals, tools, methods, its roundups, and its rodeos. From the Spaniard, the Indian, the Mexican. Changes in breed contributed by the English. The plains opened by men of all nations in the gold rush. The railroad built by Chinese, Germans, Irish.
For a long time after this great expansion, the Mexican continued to drift across the border into the United States, usually as a farm worker, a picker of fruit and vegetables. But they were few.
In the year 1900, there were no more than 100,000 Mexicans in the United States. In the year 1938, there are about 2 million Mexicans in the United States.
Where are they? What do they do? Why do they come?
In 1917, the United States is at war. Millions of men are drafted, sent to camp, shipped overseas.
Food will win the war.
Gentlemen, men will win the war. No man capable of bearing arms can be spared.
No, no, we must feed ourselves and our enemies and our brave allies. Hundreds of food ships are being sunk every month. We must grow food.
Food will win the war.
So the Mexicans are brought in, not only to the farms, but to factories and workshops. To the old skill on the soil, inherited from Aztec and Spaniard, now is added willingness to work at the machine. First, on the land.
Mexican labor was used in building hundreds of miles of irrigation canals in the Imperial Valley.
Mexican labor has helped turn the Texas Range into the Winter Garden District.
The Mexican does hard, ungrateful labor. His pay, comparatively low here, is higher than in his homeland. Yet his work is seasonal. From March to November, perhaps, he works. Then, the season over, he is left to shift for himself. Nor is the Mexican alone among Hispanic peoples to do essential labor in the United States. Cubans make cigars in Key West. Men and women of Portuguese descent pick cranberries in the bogs of Massachusetts. Spanish and Portuguese settlers pick cotton and pecans in Texas. And in our outlying islands of Puerto Rico, Americans of various stocks are working side by side with the Latin Americans.
But the Mexican in the United States remains a special case for one reason. He is the newest newcomer, although his ancestors were here before America was settled.
He is still migratory, still uncertain of his place in our life. But in recent years, he has begun to take a more active part in affairs as an American citizen. What does the Mexican bring to America?
He brings craftsmanship.
The shawls, the hats, the pottery made by Mexicans for their own daily use are objects of beauty. Largely from the inspiration of Mexican artists has come a tremendous revival of mural decoration in American public buildings. Pictures about our own lives, placed where all may see.
He brings repose.
The Mexican's temperament is a corrective to the terrific pace of the American living in big cities. He remembers his heritage of pleasurable work and many holidays. His tradition of working hard, but not so hard that he is too tired to enjoy his leisure. Perhaps the sanest and most sympathetic of all critics of America, at work and at rest, is a Spanish-American, George Santayana.
Like his Spanish and Indian ancestors, the Mexican brings desirable elements into American life. Like all other immigrants, he begins by doing the difficult jobs no one else will do. He works at low wages and tries to rise, to educate his family, to share in American life.
We have seen what Hispanic people have meant to America. And now, let us see what America has meant to the Hispanic people. We introduce Mr. Jose Camprubí, who was educated at Harvard University, for many years a distinguished engineer, and now publisher of the Pan-American newspaper for Spanish-speaking people, La Prensa, who will now tell us what America has meant to the Hispanic people. Mr. Camprubí.
As our Spanish ancestors brought from Spain to America trees like the olive and the orange, fruits such as dates and grapes, various farm products and animals such as horses, goats, sheep, and the longhorn Andalusian cattle, the Spaniards and Hispanic Americans of today have also contributed toward the upbuilding of this great country. George Santayana, mentioned a few moments ago, was born in Spain, and as professor of philosophy at Harvard University, has contributed to the formation of many American young men. Jose Iturbi, the great pianist and conductor, has become a permanent part of the first rank of musicians in this country. Artists from Spain and Hispanic America have decorated the interiors of many of the public buildings and private palaces of Americans. Artists from Spain and Hispanic America sing constantly in American broadcasts, in the theater, and on the operatic stage. Fresh in the memory of all my listeners is the graceful figure and warm, sensitive voice of that charming Spanish soprano, Lucrecia Bori, who still works hard in the advancement of music here and for the welfare and progress of opera. It is possible that I am confining myself too much to what might be termed retail trade, that is, the influence of a few really great Hispanic spirits on music, art, philosophy, and the sciences in America. It does not escape me that the fever of this era is mass production, and in this line I will say that certain types of Spanish colonial music, which flashes forth in the night through the ether waves from every broadcasting station in the land, has been an important factor in the spasms and contortions that millions of our jitterbugs suffer all over the land from the Cotton Club to the West. But getting serious once more, we have hundreds of young men from Spain, Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and most of the other 21 Hispanic nations gradually growing old in American universities, teaching Spanish literature to tens of thousands of students and thus becoming a factor in the formation of their minds. It has been for many years the unswerving policy of the State Department to promote inter-American trade, which as a result has developed to great proportions. Most of the banks have vice presidents whose native land is one of the Hispanic nations of America. The great corporations like the oil and steel and automobile companies, food products, cigarettes, and patent medicine corporations all have Spaniards and Hispanic Americans, from modest stenographers and translators to high officials familiar with tariffs, harbor rules, packing regulations, etc. Besides the local staffs, they have veritable armies of salesmen that travel back and forth between the United States and the Hispanic countries. This unswerving policy of the State Department to promote closer ties, commercial, financial, and cultural, between the Hispanic countries of America and the United States has culminated in that doctrine, slogan, or principle that the president with the true Roseville facility for the art of baptizing things, has called the policy of the good neighbor.
Thank you, Mr. Comproby. Next Sunday, Americans All, Immigrants All, will present the Scotch, Scotch-Irish, and Welsh in the United States. How the Irish and Scotch settled in frontiers and played important parts in the development of our democracy and of our schools. How the Welsh, lovers of song, worked as miners and shared in the industrial development of our country. But these Spanish immigrants you heard about today, did you ever realize how much they contributed to America? Would you like to know more about the Spanish and what they brought to America? For those of you who want to know this personal human story of the Spanish immigrant, we have prepared a leaflet. A leaflet especially for you. It tells about our Spanish heritage and our Scotch, Scotch-Irish and Welsh heritage and our English heritage. Now, it's simply yours for the asking, and it also suggests individual study, group activities, and sources of reference reading on broadcasts of this series. Learn more about your America. Write Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. Ask for the free leaflet. Remember the address, Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. Americans All, Immigrants All is a presentation of the Office of Education, Department of the Interior, with the cooperation of the Columbia Broadcasting System and the Service Bureau for Intercultural Education, with the assistance of the Works Progress Administration. Research by Mrs. Rachel Davis Dubois and Philip Leonard Green. Script by Gilbert Seldes. Original music by Rudolf Schramm, played by the Columbia Broadcasting System Orchestra under the direction of Leon Goldman. Earl McGill directed, and this is John Lang speaking. Columbia Broadcasting System.
Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. Americans All, Immigrants All. This is a story of how you, the people of the United States, made America. You and your neighbors, your parents and theirs. It is a story of the most spectacular movement of humanity in all recorded time. The movement of millions of men, women and children from other lands to the land they made their own. It is a story of what they endured and accomplished. And it is also the story of what this country did for them. Americans All, Immigrants All. As the music suggests, today we tell the story of the Orientals in the United States, particularly the story of the Chinese and Japanese, what they did in building the United States, in agriculture, in science,
It was in the 1850s that the Chinese started to come here, lured by stories of California's gold fields.
But prohibitive taxes were soon levied on Chinese gold miners, and they were forced to become the servants of the American miners. And, back in San Francisco, the servants of the miners' wives. So they established themselves as cooks, laundry workers, restaurant and hotel keepers. Efficient, faithful, cheerful, doing necessary labor, presenting no problem, so that Governor McDougal of California was moved to say,
I propose that parcels of land should be given to the Chinese who wish to become farmers, for they are among the most worthy of our newly adopted citizens.
Your people are too busy to drain the swamp lands, Your Excellency, but we will drain them and clear them and make them fertile.
I hope that more of your fellow countrymen will come to help you. California needs the work, which you can do.
Thank you, Your Excellency. If there be work for my countrymen to do, they will come.
And there was work to do. Hardly had the first fever for gold subsided when the railroad fever began. Clambering up the Sierras from San Francisco, rail by rail, climbed the tracks of the Central Pacific. Each tie laid down, each rail placed, each spike driven by
Lu Hong of Hankow.
Sam Lan Gao, Lan Chao.
Lim Fu, Rehul.
Chong Shou, Hong Kong.
Han Fong of Shanghai.
And 25,000 other willing Chinese hands pushing the twin steel ribbon inch by inch, 1,000 feet up for every mile forward, accomplishing one of the most difficult engineering feats in the history of railroading. On May 10, 1869, the Central Pacific met the lines of the Union Pacific at Promontory Point, Utah. And the first transcontinental railroad was completed. And completed, too, was the first great contribution of the Chinese to the development of the United States.
When the job was done, most of the Chinese returned to California, but many of them continued east. In Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, they became tragic pawns in the unwitting game being played between powerful employers and the workers who were then beginning to organize. In the East, the arguments against the Chinese came largely from labor leaders. In the West, as the nation felt the grip of financial panic, agitation against the Chinese broke out and grew violent. Labor, having no legal protection for minimum wages at that time, pressed for the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the measure became a law.
As soon as prosperity returned, cheap labor was needed again.
But we can't get any more Chinese. Who's going to take their place? They're the cheapest labor we ever had.
It was downright stupid to pass that Exclusion Act.
That's right. But it doesn't solve our problem. We've got to have more labor and cheap labor. And there's nothing like an Oriental.
Well, Japanese are Orientals, aren't they?
That's right. Japanese. By golly, we opened up their country to trade, didn't we? Now maybe we can get something in return.
And so Japanese labor was recruited, as Chinese labor had been 30 years before. And, like the Chinese, their story was the same. They were used by owners of coal mines in Colorado and Utah to break strikes. Labor resented them. The ranchers of California, Oregon, and Washington resented them. And finally, after a series of negotiations, the entrance of Japanese, like that of the Chinese, was limited almost to the point of exclusion.
But still there are today nearly 75,000 Chinese, nearly 140,000 Japanese in the United States, doing vital, important work in agriculture, industry, in commerce, in science, and in art.
Although thousands of Chinese live in the celebrated, picturesque, and orderly Chinatown of San Francisco, they are also in large colonies in many eastern cities and in the Middle West. The concentration of Japanese is greater on the Pacific coast, and it is there that their typical enterprises in agriculture can be found. Centuries of care and experiment in their miniature gardens and small fields had taught the Japanese to work miracles with the soil. And at Livingston, California, they worked a miracle which to this day seems unbelievable to their neighbors.
Livingston? Why, it was just a bump in the California desert till them Japanese come along.
Oh, there had been a town there once, but it just blew away. Settlers couldn't take it, I guess. And no wonder. With that wind piling sand over everything and the desert sucking up every drop of rain. Nope, there wasn't a stick left of Livingston. And one day in 1906, I come riding along, I seen them there.
Howdy, folks. You ain't lost, are you?
No, thank you. Honorable stranger, it's welcome to our miserable village.
Village? Hey, you ain't aiming to live here.
Yes, please. We will build houses, plant many fine gardens and orchards.
Well, I don't want to discourage you, but it just can't be done. Not here. You ain't got no shade trees, no water.
Plenty water 2 miles away. We will carry it.
Yeah, but everything you plant will be buried underneath the sand. You can't beat the desert, my friend.
We plant shelter trees to stop the wind.
Ah, shucks, you're just wasting your time to try. Why don't you go somewhere else?
Oh, this land very cheap. We have only little money. We stay here, please.
But folks will just laugh when they hear you're starting a village at Livingston.
Already many laugh. Even Japanese laugh at us. But we stay here.
Well, good luck to you. You'll need it. Come on, Pino.
Not much thanks for friendly good wishes. You will come again?
Sure. I'll come again. If you don't blow away. So long. Get up. Well, sir, they almost did blow away. But they stuck at it year after year, almost starving to death. And that fierce sun beating down on them. What plants weren't dried up by the wind and the sun, the grasshoppers at. I thought them Japanese had gone through all the tortures that humans could endure. Then in 1909, I heard that the bank in Frisco that held a second mortgage on their land had closed its doors. So I got on to Pinto and rode out to see my friend Chiwaki. He was in the field, as usual, digging out that everlasting sand.
Welcome to Livingston. To see honorable friend is like cool rain to a posh flower.
Well, I just heard about the bank. I thought maybe Pinto and me could be of some use around here, helping you move.
Move?
Yeah.
We do not move.
You mean you're going to stay here? But look, you ain't got no money, no crops, nothing.
We got patience, my friend. Much strength for hard work.
You can't eat patience, Chiwaki.
We need only little food. Sometimes all one family live many days for only 5 pennies.
Yeah? Well, not while I'm around, they won't. Here, I want you to take this. Oh, it ain't much,
Only as loan. I pay it back, please.
All right, but not till this town gets on its feet. You can consider that my investment in Livingston.
Thank you. But it is good investment. You will see. Someday this desert will bloom like rose, like Bible say. Someday Livingston will be a beautiful garden.
Yep, bloom like a rose, he said. And, mister, you ought to see Livingston now. They planted trees, they brought water. Now they got a cooperative society to market fruit. And a packing house all their own, and the land there is worth $175 an acre. Now they're raising grapes and raisins and figs and the best almond orchard in all the state, all growing on what we call a desert. Now, I call that a miracle, mister.
It's the kind of miracle which the Japanese have repeated many times, as they seem to have a special knack for reclaiming land from the desert, restoring soil which has been exhausted, draining swamplands, all with infinite patience. One Japanese, George Shima, the Potato King, diked island after island in the San Joaquin River Delta, bringing thousands of barren acres under cultivation. Other Japanese also reclaimed much land and paid millions of dollars in land rent for the soil they had saved. Like the Japanese, the Chinese seem to have an aptitude for scientific farming. Across the continent from California, in the northern part of Florida, the Chinese Lu Gim Gong created new varieties of grapefruit, raspberries and tomatoes, and an orange.
This orange, perhaps you would care to taste it for yourself.
You see, the pulp is just as firm and juicy as in udder. You like it? Yes, it is sweet. But its great advantage is that it can be stored right here on the tree without spoiling. It does not have to be picked until you want to ship it. Why, some of those have been hanging on that tree for the past 4 years. Frost? No, it does not seem to bother them. It was right after the big freeze of 96 I set to work to grow that orange. Most of the growers around here moved south, but I stayed to see what I could do about it. Across a hot slate with a Mediterranean sweet, and this is the result. America? Well, I just wanted to come. I brought along some silks to sell and worked my way across the country. I am very grateful for all America has given me. I have tried to pay back my debt with this orange. Yes, I suppose it might have made me rich. But in China, we have an old saying that he who has money but no friends is not rich. And he who has friends but no money is not poor.
The Oriental, both Japanese and Chinese, has often succeeded in business. But the active, rushing method of American industrial and commercial life is not natural to the tradition of the Orient. It is not surprising, therefore, that some of the greatest contributions to these immigrants have been in the sciences where long and patient research, rather than quick action, is needed.
Take the case of one Japanese, Jokichi Takamina.
Born in the year Perry opened Japan to trade.
Represented Japan at the New Orleans Exposition. Married a daughter of a Civil War veteran.
Brought to America a new process in the manufacture of alcohol.
Discovered a substitute for glycerin in printing.
Brought Japanese art and ideas into friendly connection with America. Establishing clubs, planting the Japanese cherry trees in public parks.
And as the climax of a great career, Takamina gave the world the invaluable drug adrenaline, a stimulant, a preventive of bleeding, which revolutionized surgery and has even been used to revive those given up for dead.
And just as Takamina was isolating adrenaline, a fellow countryman of his was coming to America, knocking at the door of opportunity here. Knocking, in fact, at the door of Simon Flexner's office at the University of Pennsylvania. Come in.
Good morning, Dr. Flexner.
Good morning. You wish to see me?
Noguchi traveled many miles to see you.
Oh?
Doctor, not remember?
I remember your face. You're one of the students here?
I'm Noguchi.
Noguchi?
Hideo Noguchi, Tokyo Medical Institute.
Oh, yes, of course. You're the young man who showed me through the institute. I remember. You wanted to come to America one day to study medicine.
At last, they arrive. I'm here.
Well, well, that's fine. And I'm glad to welcome you to the university.
Sir, most kind. Feel so glad forget present. Kindly forgive bad manners.
Presents? Are these for me?
Very poor presents. Poor things for position doctor offer me on faculty of university.
A position? Well, there must be some mistake. I made no such offer.
In Tokyo, Noguchi say, want to go to America.
Oh, but I merely agreed that it would be fine if you could go.
You say, write letter, tell what I do in medicine.
Yes, I received that letter.
Was very poor letter?
Oh, on the contrary, it was unusually good.
Then we'll have position, yes?
Well, I'm afraid there's no position open.
Noguchi come 10,000 miles all the way from Japan. Now you say...
Wait, just a moment. Oh, let's try to understand each other. I thought you wanted to come here to study.
But always when study must work too. I'm not rich samurai. I'm poorest farming class in Japan.
I see. And you thought that your letter would arrange everything. I'm sorry, Mr. Noguchi, but I'm afraid I can't help you. You see, there's a rule that no foreigners are to be admitted to our faculty.
No foreigners. But what Noguchi to do?
Perhaps you had better go back.
Back? To Japan? But all my life want to come to America. Always work hard. Study hard. Teach myself English from grammar book. Sometimes no rice, but do not care. I say, someday we'll go to America. Now, day is here. Cannot go back.
I understand. Well, perhaps with that determination, something can be done about it. Have you enough money to keep you for a while?
No, but we'll work. Hardship. Even if destroy body.
But you are so small, and, well, you'd be limited in the kind of work you can do.
Oh, yes. Doctor, look at left hand. When a tiny child crawl into charcoal fire, burn off fingers. Now have only one hand, but this hand strong, like two. When we shake hands...
Yes, your hand is strong, but a doctor's work requires the greatest skill and delicacy. It's hard enough when he has two hands to work with.
Doctor, right. Cannot be surgeon, but can be bacteriologist. See? Can hold test tube between stumps of burned fingers, like this.
A bacteriologist, eh? Yes, I believe you can. Anyone who can overcome the difficulties you've had to contend with.
Then, Noguchi stay?
You certainly may. We'll create a position for you.
So Hideo Noguchi became assistant to Simon Flexner. And when Flexner was made director of the new Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research in New York, Noguchi went along. There, true to his promise, he worked. He made important discoveries about snake venom and discovered a new method of diagnosing syphilis that won him the acclaim of the entire medical world. Simon Flexner was proud of his pupil.
Noguchi, I knew that you were a very unusual person that first day when you walked into my office, but I didn't realize that you were a genius.
Genius? No such thing, genius. Work 3, 4, 5 times harder than anyone else. That genius.
And Noguchi worked on rabies, on trachoma, on infantile paralysis, and finally on yellow fever. Going to South America, he worked with actual cases until he had discovered the germ that caused the disease and created a serum that prevented it. Then, in September 1927, word came from Dr. Adrian Stokes at the Rockefeller staff in West Africa that he couldn't find Noguchi's germ in the blood of yellow fever patients over there. Stokes' letter also said that he was about to return to America for his vacation. In fact, he was planning to sail on the next boat. Noguchi decided to take Stokes' place.
Dr. Flexner, Noguchi must go to Africa.
Let a younger man go, Noguchi. You're past 50 and far too valuable to send out there.
Doctor, I think perhaps Noguchi not come back?
My Africa guards her secrets well.
Not afraid. Must finish work. Maybe Africa yellow fever different. If wrong, germ not true cause. Dr. Flexner, Noguchi must go.
Dale, you're much too valuable here. Yes, come in.
Pardon me, doctor, but this cablegram just came. I thought it might be important.
Oh, from Africa. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Maybe Stokes stay there for vacation.
Noguchi?
What is it?
Stokes is dead.
Dead?
Died of yellow fever at Lagos.
This decided. Noguchi must go.
It's too dangerous.
Doctor, not to worry about Noguchi. Noguchi no yellow fever. We'll win down there or die.
Noguchi went to Africa, and he was about to return to New York for a final check on his researches, was struck down by yellow fever and died. A few days later, his only assistant, Dr. William A. Young, also succumbed. And no one ever knew what Noguchi's last discoveries had been. But the world knew that Stokes, Young, Noguchi, American, Briton, and Japanese had given their lives to save the lives of others.
men of science, painters, poets, have come to the United States from China and Japan. Through their great men, these nations have influenced generations of Americans.
The American painter James McNeill Whistler was deeply influenced by the Japanese Hokusai, and through Whistler, a whole generation of painters.
And the American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson was deeply influenced by the sages of India and of China, particularly by Confucius.
In unsuspected ways, the Oriental love of decoration and form influences our furniture, our flowers, our manners.
When the world powers imposed an indemnity on China after the Boxer Rebellion, the United States allowed its share to be used to give scholarships to Chinese students. These indemnity students have been the most powerful force in connecting the civilizations of China and the United States.
The Oriental temperament, differing widely from the Western, has elements of nobility all its own, a nobility which pervades even the smallest actions of daily life. Take a tiny incident in the Chinatown of New York. There, as in all the other Chinatowns throughout America, juvenile delinquency is rare. There, within a radius of 8 city blocks, live 8,000 people, and yet the delinquency rate is lower than in any other area of the city. But there was a case back in 1926.
Eddie Wu, age 12. What's the charge, officer?
Truancy, Your Honor. He's been absent from school a week.
Where did you find him?
On a bench down at Battery Park, watching the boats go by.
Mm-hmm. And this man is his father, huh?
Yes, sir.
Can you speak English, Mr. Wu?
I try sincerely, Your Honor.
Do you realize that this is the first Chinese boy I've had in the children's court for 23 years?
I humbly apologize to the United States government for my son's heinous offense. I am completely ashamed.
Why did you run away from school, Eddie?
Please, sir. Teacher said that we are all naughty boys in class. She said, you cause me great pain. You are very bad. So, not to make her feel sad and suffer, I didn't go to school.
Well,
Honorable sir, before you pass sentence upon my great criminal of a son, may I make a statement?
What is it?
Upon my own ill-mannered self is the blame for his misdeeds. I have not properly instructed him in the virtues of scholarship. Therefore, kindly sentence me to prison in place of my unknowing son.
You?
Please, sir. I am at fault. I have lost much face.
Well, this is the first time I've ever known a parent to take the blame. They usually blame the teacher.
When a child is bad in Chinatown, it is always the parent who is blamed. A man's first duty to his country, his neighbors, and himself is to train his child properly.
Well, no wonder they're never delinquent.
But I have failed, Honorable Judge. All Chinatown feels this disgrace. You will sentence me?
I won't sentence either of you. Sentence suspended.
Thank you, sir. I assure you that I shall never again disgrace myself, nor shall my ex-criminal of a son prove himself a bad example to his American neighbors.
Oh, I don't think Eddie meant to play truant.
He must learn to obey the American law. For punishment, he will be forbidden to go anywhere except to the American school from 9 to 3 o'clock and the Chinese school from 4 till 7. I shall take away all his toys and refuse to speak to him for 2 months.
Now, see here, Mr. Wu. Don't you think you're being rather hard on the boy? After all, he didn't do anything really bad.
In Chinatown, Honorable Judge, we punish the first offense and do not wait until the misdeed grows stupendous. Our ancient teacher, Confucius, has said that as the young twig is bent, so the tree will grow.
The wisdom of the Orient, expressed in daily life or in art or science or thoughts of the philosophers, must be the great contribution of the Japanese and the Chinese to American life. Coming here originally as manual workers and doing their work well, they are now limited in numbers, and it is hard for them to enter completely into many phases of American life. But in a country dedicated to freedom of the individual, The Oriental immigrant makes us understand that people with different habits of mind can live harmoniously side by side. We have seen how the patient labor of Chinese and Japanese has reclaimed land from the desert, created new crops, made vital discoveries in medical science, and how the Oriental habit of life, dignified, formal, and humane, can bring something of the highest value to our own lives.
You know, when you go to the theater, you're given a program, a guide to the evening's entertainment. Theater managers consider that printed program a necessary aid to your understanding and enjoyment of the play. And we believe a program is still more important than a radio drama. Americans All, Immigrants All offers you free of charge a program that will be a guide to every broadcast of this series. And it's an unusual one, for it has pictures, maps, and charts in the form of a printed booklet. This booklet is what you need to have before your eyes as you listen to these broadcasts, to read after the broadcast is over, and to keep. So get your program, your free booklet, by writing to Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. A postcard will do. Remember the address, Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. Next Sunday, Americans All, Immigrants All will present Italians in America. Americans All, Immigrants All is a presentation of the United States Department of the Interior Office of Education with the cooperation of CBS and the Service Bureau for Intercultural Education with the assistance of the Works Progress Administration. Research by Rachel Davis DuBois and Philip Leonard Green. Script by Gilbert Seldes. The original music by Rudolf Schramm was played by the string ensemble, Leon Goldman conducting. The entire production was under the direction of William N. Robeson. The story... The story of Eddie Wu, the Chinese delinquent, is from Number One Bad Boy by Carl Glick. Permission for its use has been granted through the courtesy of the author, the New York Herald Tribune magazine, This Week, and Reader's Digest. For the free booklet on the achievements of all of America's peoples, write to Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
If you're tired of outrageously expensive cell phone bills, come on over to Mint Mobile. Talk, text, and data plans just start at $15 a month. There are no contracts. Sign up and Mint will send you a SIM card. Just insert it into your phone. You can even keep your old number.
So don't make your cell phone provider rich. Keep that money in your wallet. Go to krobcollection.com for details on Mint Mobile.
From the KROB Collection, this has been Audio Antiques, featuring classic shows from the golden age of American radio. This podcast emanates from Anchor.fm and can be heard on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, Spotify, CastBox, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Google Podcasts, and others. You can contact us at audioantiques@krobcollection.com. Our theme music is by hbeats330@gmail.com. I'm Ken Robinson. Thanking our many listeners in the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, India, Germany, Ireland, Canada, Ukraine, Bhutan, Spain, Poland, the Netherlands, France, and 73 other nations around the world. Glad to have you with us.